3, 4.
What is the true meaning of the pursuit of happiness? What can we learn from the Founding Fathers about achieving harmony, balance, tranquility, self-mastery, and pursuing the public good?
Jeffrey Rosen is a professor at the George Washington University Law School. He is also the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and a contributing editor of The Atlantic. He has authored several books across a variety of topics in American history and law, including Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet, and the official companion book of the award-winning PBS series The Most Democratic Branch, How the Courts Serve America. Rosen has also contributed to The New Yorker and National Public Radio in addition to other media sources.
His latest book is The Pursuit of Happiness, How Classical Writers on Virtue Inspired the Lives of the Founders and Defined America. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome to the Creative Process of One Planet podcast.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
And so your book really came out at the right time. I think we're all thinking about how we might plant trees for another century. So before we, you know, launch into the conversation, I believe you've selected a sonnet from The Pursuit of Happiness.
Yes, this is from Cicero's Tusculan Disputations. This morning haze obscures the firmament, sunlight and clouds in serried blue alloy. A narrow clearing opens, fortune sent. I glimpse a sparkling sunbeam and feel joy. Stoics praise calm joy without elation, its motion placid and to reason aligned. When it transports wanton exultation, it fires the perturbations of the mind. The four disordered passions are emotions that lack the moderation reason brings. Elation, lust, fear, grief are their commotions. Prudence and temperance are their golden rings. The soul that's tranquil, calm, restrained, at rest, the happy soul, the subject of our quest.
You know, each one of those words opens up new lines of thought. And I can see this whole book is really a journey inwards and contemplation of the original and true meaning of the pursuit of happiness and how to live a good life. So you described in the writing of this book, the text of the Tusculan Disputations, which inspired so many of the founding fathers as having also transformed your life. What do you think it is about those books that you found so moving that they would inspire you not just to read and reflect on them, change your daily rituals, but to also take it a step further and write your own sonnets in response?
Being moved to write the sonnets was an unexpected gift that I was given. I certainly didn't expect that unusual practice, but I found myself moved to sum up the wisdom in concise and distilled form just by taking notes on the daily reading that I'd done each morning after watching the sunrise. And I was surprised to learn after starting the project that many people who read this wisdom during the founding era were also moved to write sonnets, including Phyllis Wheatley, the great poet, Mercy Otis Warren, Alexander Hamilton, and John Quincy Adams, who would read the Tusculan Disputations in the original and read Cicero in the original in the White House for consolation, write sonnets and watch the sunrise and walk along the Potomac. You quoted in your introduction that idea of planting seeds for future generations, and that passage came from the Tusculan Disputations, and Adams adopted it as his own motto. There's something especially empowering about Cicero, which after all is a manual on grief. And it's very striking that Adams and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and so many in the founding era viewed this manual about overcoming grief as the definition for achieving happiness. I think it's because it's a philosophy of self-mastery, self-improvement, and self-empowerment.
Yes, and of course, not to go too much into Cicero's life, of course, that is that text, he was overcoming grief after the death of his daughter. It's so interesting because when we think about what for many is the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't often contain that underside. We're not reflective on the true virtues at its core. Can you describe the overall organizing principle of the book and the 12 virtues and how you went about selecting the founding fathers that you chose to write about?
I was moved to organize the book according to 12 virtues by noting the incredible synchronicity that both Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson made lists of 12 or 13 virtues for achieving happiness. And I knew about Franklin's famous system for achieving moral perfection, which he writes about in his autobiography, where he made a list of 13 virtues for self-mastery. But I was just struck by the coincidence of seeing on the wall of the Boar's Head Inn in Charlottesville, Virginia, on the UVA campus, a list of 12 virtues that Jefferson had drafted for his daughters. And they were almost identical to Franklin's. And the fact that both had chosen these 12 virtues seemed like a natural organizing principle for the book. And then, of course, I wanted to tell the stories through people because that's the best way to relate to an attempt to practice self-mastery, to see how people achieved it in their own lives. And then I just chose different founders to associate with different virtues. It seemed like a good way of telling the stories through their lives' journeys.
Yes. And for you, which are the virtues most need maintaining or reflecting upon? I mean, just talk us through the different virtues.
Well, it's important that although you can disaggregate them, they're really clusters of the same quest. They're all glosses on the four classical virtues of temperance, prudence, courage, and justice. And they're all attempts to achieve self-mastery. And in that sense, tranquility, moderation, these are different ways of expressing the ideas of prudence and temperance. It's striking that Adam Smith translated the Roman word temperance here, temperance, with virtue as a kind of tranquility of the soul. And when I tried to practice the Franklin 13 virtues, which I did a couple years ago at the recommendation of a rabbi who suggested the Hebrew version, a Hasidic rabbi in the 19th century had translated Franklin's virtues into Hebrew. And a friend and I tried to practice them without actually knowing that they came from Franklin. I found that separating them or disaggregating them, as Franklin recommends, focusing on temperance one week, for example, and industry another, is less successful than thinking of them holistically. Really practicing the virtues, it's more of a vibe than a checklist. And in that sense, it's a feeling of alignment, harmony, balance, tranquility, self-mastery that you achieve once you've internalized the wisdom. So that was my experience, but we could certainly talk about individual virtues, which are, of course, a great way to try to achieve the state that Franklin recommended.
Yes. And of course, we didn't really touch on how this came about, which was during the pandemic and the virtue of silence. And of course, this pandemic experience gave you a different understanding of these virtues. I mean, can you imagine writing this book not during the pandemic?
Yes, the pandemic was crucial. I don't think I would have been moved to set aside 2 hours in the morning for deep reading without the fact that we were all at home. I sort of felt the license to try an unusual project, which led in all sorts of unexpected places. But the takeaway, if I can be so reductionistic, was that the habits of deep reading are themselves the most tangible expression of the virtues. And in that sense, the virtue of industry is the one that I take with me still. So many of the founders did too. They fell short of so many virtues, as we all do every day. But it was the habits of deep reading and writing, and also of keeping up a consistent daily schedule and setting aside time for deep reading and writing that they maintained until the end of their lives. And that's the most tangible way in which the project changed my life. The pandemic is over. I have a new book project, but each morning I'm still setting aside time for deep reading and writing and creative work as well, where I'm not allowed to look at screens or do all the things that I'm tempted to do, of course, every minute. And that habit of industry is something that I'm really grateful for.
Yes. And you mentioned how they fell short. I mean, we're kind of lumping them together. We should speak about them individually. We were talking about John Quincy Adams or others who might have not fallen short. He was really set on his own perfection and self-mastery. And others, with regards to slavery and abolition, they were aware of all these virtues. At the same time, they couldn't find it within themselves to perhaps have that level of self-mastery.
Yes, slavery is the most glaring, notorious, and important hypocrisy to discuss. How was it possible that these founders, all of whom acknowledge that slavery violated natural rights and natural justice, themselves owned slaves? And it was striking to discover that they didn't even try. That Patrick Henry quote is so significant. He said, "Is it not amazing that I myself, who believe that slavery is immoral, myself own slaves? I will not justify it. I won't attempt to. It's simple avarice or greed. I can't do with the inconvenience of living without them." And that idea that these men who insisted that virtues like industry and frugality were so important, and that avarice or ambition were such sins, themselves just couldn't be bothered to give up the lifestyle. It was indeed their addiction to the ease that enslavement made possible that led to this hypocrisy. It's striking that they viewed this hypocrisy in classical terms, and also that they didn't attempt to justify it, and were reminded that the pursuit of happiness is indeed a pursuit. It's not a place that anyone expects to arrive at, because to arrive at the final destination would mean to achieve moral perfection.
Yes, I think we can never quite get there, but that's the beauty of the struggle. Why do you feel that the virtues were so important to them? I think that at the time you write about, there was a stage of feeling that democracy was still an experiment that they weren't sure would actually stick. So just expand upon why they felt it was important to have in their daily practice and what that meant for governance.
It's crucial for governance because the founders, for the first time in world history, drew a central connection between personal self-government and political self-government. It was the first time in history, because never before had a nation established the proposition that people could be governed by reason and conviction, not force or violence, as Hamilton put it in Federalist One. And previous democracies had fallen the way of Greece and Rome. The founders, adopting classical political theory, assume that monarchies are based on fear, oligarchies on honor, and democracies on virtue, on the self-restraint of the people. Rather than trying a pure democracy, they were going to try for the first time to construct a democratic republic limited by a written constitution. And that made it crucial that the people find virtuous self-mastery on a wide scale. The complexity of the system was its recognition of popular sovereignty, the idea that we, the people of the United States as a whole, are sovereign. And that created a special importance on the education of public opinion. And this was Madison's great insight, that by using new media technologies to cool and refine public opinion through the broadside press, people might achieve moderation and temperance. It was so striking to discover that the Constitution is based on a particular political psychology that was also applied to the pursuit of happiness, and that the separation of powers between the executive, Senate, and House were meant to mirror the faculties of the human mind. And it was just an example of how central this classical philosophy was to the founders, that they attempted to apply it not only in the constitutions of their own mind, but also in the constitutions of the state.
It's so fascinating to think of the body politic in that way as a metaphor. And so when you're talking about James Madison and believing there shouldn't be so much direct communication between the president and the American people, fast forward to today, and now we have tweeting presidents and going on TikTok, the founding fathers, they had other things to contend with, but they didn't have this accelerated pace of not just social media, but the way journalism has been transforming. So what are your reflections on that, and how they would be able to cope in this world?
Well, it's a grave challenge to the Madisonian faith. Madison hopes that a class of enlightened journalists he calls the literati, which is a phrase he gets from Condorcet, will, by writing complicated arguments like the Federalist Papers and the newspapers, slowly educate and refine public opinion. And the fact that Instagram and X, or whatever it's called, and TikTok are the opposite of that is a serious challenge. Similarly serious is the fact that many have lost the habits of deep reading that are really necessary for the experiment to survive. The founders thought it was imperative that people seek out information, listen to arguments from different perspectives, deliberate with their fellow citizens before making up their own mind. That crucial right is also a duty, to think as you will and speak as you think, as Jefferson said, quoting from Tacitus's famous defense of free speech. And when people substitute their own duty to make up their own mind with partisanship, where they just adopt the opinions of the most mobilized extremes, that really is a serious threat to the entire experiment.
Indeed. The way society is designed these days, and these institutions, these media companies, we are encouraged to make up our mind before we really have the facts.
The idea of being moved by opinion rather than fact, and expressing allegiance to an ideology rather than being open-minded to evidence, is the definition of a faction. A faction is any group, either a majority or a minority, animated by passion rather than reason, devoted to self-interest rather than the public good. And that's exactly what the algorithmic rabbit holes and filter bubbles and echo chambers encourage. And it's a serious threat.
You know, we discussed how the Stoics had influenced the founding fathers in some of their documents, but I was surprised that even texts like the Bhagavad Gita helped inform their worldview. This internationalism that you wouldn't hear an American politician speaking in this way today, it wouldn't speak to the electorate, say, to quote these diverse sources, and to have that deep knowledge, that deep learning, and long worldview.
Yes. Wasn't it inspiring to see Adams and Jefferson trading reading recommendations about world religions in their old age? And Adams was so excited when he learned that Pythagoras may have traveled to the East and read the Hindu Vedas, and he's so eager to read the New English translation of the Bhagavad Gita, and then with his remarkable synthetic mind distills the common wisdom of the East and West in the idea that we think life is shaped by the mind, which he sees such deep similarities with the Stoic wisdom that we should focus on the only thing we can control, which is our own thoughts and emotions rather than the thoughts of others. And he distills that into his own creed, which he attributes to the hymn of Cleanthes, love God and all his creatures, rejoice in all things. It's the most inspiring truth about Adams and Jefferson in old age. And it's a sign of their willingness to follow the truth wherever it may lead, not to rest on ideology or to be stuck in current politics, but to continue to learn and grow and note the similarities and differences among traditions. It was significant that Jefferson at the end of his life said, I've given up newspapers for Tacitus. And it's an inspiration, I think, that when all of us become old, we can find learning and growth in the wisdom of the past rather than being caught up in current controversies.
Indeed, there's a difference between wisdom and information. And the way we read now, talking about technology companies, they call us data subjects. It's quite dehumanizing. So, because moral philosophy wasn't part of my education, and usually religious teachings are separated from our educational models. So it seems that we've lost something in that moral education that goes with the religious education. And how might we introduce it in a way that doesn't impose religious faith upon people, but recognizes the other values embedded in those teachings?
Yes, that's a central question of how to live a purpose-driven life, which each individual has to decide for him or herself. I remember yearning for this kind of moral guidance when I was in college. I was reading the Puritans and was unconvinced by Puritan theology. I didn't have a traditional religious education from my Jewish parents, and I yearned for an answer to the question of whether a purpose-driven life could be achieved by reason and conviction rather than revelation or blind faith. And I found it very empowering to discover this wondrous universe of moral philosophy. But of course, it's an individual quest for everyone. And in addition to reading the classical moral philosophers, I reread the Old and New Testament and the Gita and the Dhammapada. And for me, reading in the range of wisdom traditions was empowering and clarifying. How could it be taught on a wide scale? For most of American history, people got this in school, not only from the classics themselves, but from samplers like the McGuffey Reader or the Columbian Orator, which so inspired Frederick Douglass, excerpts from religious texts and elsewhere. That kind of miscellany has dropped out of the curriculum for many reasons, including a correct desire not to mix church and state. The Supreme Court rightly held that the two couldn't be combined, although it didn't require all texts with any religious content at all to be removed from school if they were taught for moral reasons. But I think that there's no easy answer to this question. At the National Constitution Center, we're trying to put all of this great wisdom online, including primary texts from the founders' libraries and the texts that inspired the founders, and are offering free courses in how the founders applied these lessons in their own lives, which perhaps some will find of interest. But it is urgently important that no government try to prescribe this kind of teaching, but that each individual be given the resources to discover it for themselves.
And indeed, I should also mention, if those that don't have a chance to visit the center or if their schools are not engaging with the National Constitution Center, you have these curriculum packs that you send out to people. You have a podcast, We the People, as well, and you can pick up some of these topics that you're discussing and apply it to our contemporary political issues.
I was also interested in how we might apply classical virtue to the modern day, in particular, keeping in view the way that Alexis de Tocqueville seems to refer to the United States as intrinsically, even problematically individualistic. I was wondering, to what extent do you think that a return to classical virtue will help us develop a stronger concern for others?
Well, it's worth trying. Tocqueville, of course, when he talked about self-interest, rightly understood, was talking about the pursuit of happiness. That was his formulation for the classical idea of self-mastery and self-reliance, which for Tocqueville, as for the classical authorities, would allow the individual to serve society as a whole. It was by mastering our own ego-based emotions and passions that we could be our best self and serve others. And that's why Tocqueville thought that both a reflection on the fact that our own long-term interests are best served by self-mastery, as well as what he called the spirit of religion, properly understood, might counteract the excessive individualism that afflicted modern society. I do think that the classical authorities were right, and that by mastering ourselves, we do best prepare ourselves for democratic citizenship, recognizing that we are not islands and that our immediate impulses and most ego-based emotions have to be tempered so that we can serve society as a whole.
And just on that note, you know, I'm here in France and just thinking about Alexis de Tocqueville, and I also believe you have been knighted, you've received the Chevalier of l'Ordre des Arts et Lettres.
Yes, extremely honored to receive that wonderful award.
So, as you mentioned, it seems like happiness is relative to our capacity for self-governance or self-legislation. And given the way that practical freedom and happiness seem to go hand in hand, I was wondering if, for you, freedom, like Immanuel Kant suggests, is also something made possible by self-legislation, which in the state, at least, takes the form of external constraints upon our actions.
Yes, the wise restraints that make us free. A formulation at Harvard Law School or Brandeis love to quote Goethe, "In limits, we the limitless explore." I love the Leonard Bernstein quotation from his Young People's Concerts about how Beethoven's choice of a single note in the Eroica mirrors the choice of wise restraints in a democracy. And Bernstein says that freedom is not limitless autonomy like some hippies like to think. It's the ability to make wise choices that will best allow us to serve society as a whole.
Yes, it's so interesting to think about that note of beauty, that note of harmony, which seems to be lost these days. It's so often when you talk about political discourse these days, we're so much in conflict, it's bipartisan. This idea of a perfect union or something in harmony where we're all artists working together for a collective vision seems to be lost.
Yes, I love Bernstein's excitement in talking about how, he says, for Beethoven, was he the best harmonist? No. Was it his orchestral abilities? Absolutely not. It was just that each note that he chose was exactly the right note to follow the note that preceded it, as if he had a telephone wire to God, and that he was channeling the note that created and mirrored the divine harmonies of the universe. And it was so striking to see John Adams compare the harmonies of a great piece by Handel to the harmonies of the state. And harmony is truth, which is reason, which is the divine, according to the classical authority. And we have not only a right, but a duty to live according to reason in order to align ourselves with the divine harmonies of the universe. And that's why seeking that kind of harmony through art and nature is as important, or more important, than trying to achieve harmony through politics. The quest for individual and collective self-mastery is really a search for harmony.
You spoke about the beauty of the natural world and how we often don't take time to have that communion. During the time of pandemic or now, because as you say, you've changed your daily rituals, what are your reflections about the beauty and wonder of the natural world, and how does that inspire you as you plant trees for the next century?
There's no more beautiful experience in the world than watching the sunrise. The daily practice of waking up to watch the sunrise and being full of wonder at the extraordinary beauty that awaits us each day, recapitulating each morning the harmony of creation. It's incredibly exciting. And then I just developed these practices of trying to do something creative along with the sunrise. During COVID, it was writing sonnets. Before that, I'd been writing other kinds of poems. Recently, I've started writing songs. And there's just something about the golden hour of the sunrise that waits for us each day. And whatever else is going on in the world or in our lives allows us to recommit to and experience once more the glorious beauty and harmony of the universe.
I would love to hear your songs when you're ready to share them.
I like them very much. I haven't shared them yet, but for me, they're beautiful and pleasing. And the goal is to just write music that is pleasing and harmonious.
That's wonderful. Well, it's an open invitation. We have many, you know, musicians on our shows. Would you like now to share one of your sonnets about the natural world?
I think it would be hard to pick one out that is not in the book just because I haven't published them. But I spent about a year or so before COVID just writing songs of the sunrise. And it still just fills me with so much gratitude that we can watch the sunrise every day.
And so I love that, you know, don't suppress that creative response. It's so important when we're so riven by conflict just to find those moments.
Right. And given the way that you designate time away from technology for creative pursuits or the kinds of activities that strengthen self-mastery, I was wondering what you make of recent concerns about freedom and technology, the idea being that because big tech interferes with our capacity to use our attention, it undermines our autonomy. So to what extent do you believe that owning our attention makes us more autonomous?
There's no more empowering act for me than simply turning the devices off. The simple rule that I'm not allowed to browse in the morning until I've done my reading has opened up worlds. And so much of tech and the net are designed to capture our attentions, to turn us into consumers rather than citizens, to fan our basest passions and emotions and send us down rabbit holes, that the best thing we can do is to turn it off. The pictures in our minds, I guess that was Walter Lippmann, are confirmed by the Enlightenment empiricists like John Locke, who insist that our reality is shaped by our external sensations and what we put into our minds. And then, of course, we are what we think. Life shaped by the mind is the Dhammapada. And then the great injunction that my dad used to quote from Paracelsus, as we imagine ourselves to be, so shall we be. So it's so important to exercise autonomous self-control over the pictures and images that we put into our minds. And the best thing we can do is to turn them off.
Yes. I think for those who have really done that deep reading and have these journeys inward like yourself, I can see it. I mean, you close your eyes when you're speaking, and I can see that you are going back in history. When you read the Constitution, these are not just words. You're having direct conversations with history. And so we have to train ourselves and not feel so in relationship with the present and the next moment, the next like or the next thing, but to be able to go back and imagine that wisdom and reconnect with it.
It's a weird habit I know I have, but I think it's just comes from the new habit of deep reading, which I picked up again during COVID. And you have to have read a text relatively recently to be able to recall it. It's harder to recall stuff from long ago. And I find closing my eyes helps me do that.
I think it's beautiful because it's like what you see in musicians when they sometimes close their eyes when they're connecting with the spirit or summoning the music. Because I actually feel that you are like a translator of these voices and that you're speaking to these people like they're friends, like you know them, you've lived in their text and their world. And so that takes an imaginative act, of course. You can live other lives through that deep reading.
But isn't that the excitement of primary text? It still blows my mind that I was able to read all these texts just lying on my couch because they're all online. And when you read the words themselves of these thinkers throughout history, they're speaking to you and they're communicating. Only connect, of course. E.M. Forster's injunction is the truth of any writer who's trying to communicate. And all of time melts away when we read these texts. They're speaking directly to us, and suddenly their words become our own.
When you think about that expression, planting trees for future centuries, you know, I think another issue is we don't have this perspective of the long time. How do you prioritize those trees for future generations that you're planting today?
Well, just try to use each moment as productively as possible. You have no control over the way the future will receive us. Well, certainly everything we do will be likely forgotten, but trying in as true a way as possible to distill truth and make it accessible. You know, Homer talks about the purpose of art being to instruct and delight, and that's the goal, and that I have to teach myself. There's no point in writing anything unless I'm learning it. I also love Leonard Bernstein's observation that in German, the word for teacher is Lerner. And you read, you learn, and then you try to teach in a way that's useful, but importantly, also delightful or amusing and conveys in an engaging way the excitement and enthusiasm that I have from learning.
All of the people in your books have been your teachers, whether you've known them directly, like with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or indirectly through their books. But who have been the important teachers in your life? You mentioned your father and other collaborators.
I'm so glad you asked because I'm so grateful to these teachers every day. They're with me every day. My father, great hypnotherapist and guru who died at 95, just as I was finishing the book, was with me at every stage. And his empowering message that as we imagine ourselves to be, so shall we be, helped me see the connections between the hypnotherapy that he practiced and the great wisdom traditions. My superb teachers at the Dalton School in New York, where I went to high school in English, Hortense Tyroller, Michael Berthold, history, Jeffrey Gunn, Paul, poet, chemistry, Margot Gunport, so importantly kindled in me this love of reading and learning. And then in college, I just had the extraordinary privilege of studying with great humanists in history and literature. Walter Jackson Bate wrote the towering biography of Samuel Johnson and taught the age of Johnson, insisted that the humanities could be put to use and could teach us how to live. And through his love of poetry and prose of the 18th century, both taught me how to write and hear the music and language, and also inspired in me this urgent belief in the necessity of the humanities to teach us how to live. And his great collection on the critical texts of criticism throughout the ages, beginning with the Greeks. And it's just a wonderful font of learning. And then Zach Van Berkovich, the great scholar of Puritanism, who inspired me on the quest that culminated in this book, or Judith Schlar, the great political philosopher, who wrote about the founders and their ordinary vices in her great book. And then, of course, Bernard Balin, the astonishing American historian who changed our understanding of the Revolution by focusing on its ideological origins, are just some of the amazing teachers in college. And then, if that weren't enough, you know, Dayenu, as we say in the Jewish tradition, that would have been enough if those were the only teachers. But then I went to law school and studied with the great Akhil Amar, my dear teacher and friend, who just got me so excited about studying the text and history of the Constitution and viewing constitutional history as a tapestry of how to structure society today. Bruce Ackerman, who was another great constitutional historian. Owen Fiss, who I just had the incredible pleasure of seeing the other week, who was such an inspiring teacher of the values of law and the importance of equality, are just a handful of the amazing teachers that I was fortunate enough to have.
And of course, you're a teacher, and I don't know what you're teaching currently. How are you passing on beyond your books? What are you focusing on at the moment?
So I teach constitutional law in the fall, and recently, since COVID, I've started an unusual approach, which we call slow constitutional law. And we're selecting just a handful of Supreme Court decisions and reading them out loud from beginning to end, including Dobbs, the decision overturning Roe v. Wade, and Plessy versus Ferguson, and Brown v. Board of Education, the slaughterhouse cases, and a few more. And there's something about that careful act of slow reading that helps you both get the vibe of the majority opinion and the dissent, and really allows all of us to evaluate the best arguments on both sides slowly and for ourselves. It was another approach that kind of came from my COVID era deep reading, and I hope students like it.
My name is Virginia Moschetti, and I'm a student at the London School of Economics focusing on contemporary political philosophy. Throughout my studies, I've been taught that artistic and so-called rational pursuits are situated on opposite sides of the intellectual spectrum. Whereas reason is the locus of politics and science, art encompasses literature, painting, and creativity. But reflecting upon Jeffrey Rosen's literary account of the United States Constitution, the strict binary between art and reason no longer seems to hold. Construed as a kind of narrative, the Constitution becomes available for new interpretive approaches, ones that border equally on literary criticism and legal scholarship. Taking up fragments such as the pursuit of happiness in their full symbolic totality, one definite reading feels impossible. We can no longer justifiably reduce the pursuit of happiness to its prima facie meaning as a license to do the things we believe will make us happy. Instead, exploring its fullness, attending deeply to its semantic inflections and contextual nuances, different meanings become apparent. We start to perceive the Founding Fathers' commitments to Stoic virtues, their view that happiness inheres in self-legislation, or the constraint of hedonistic pleasure. Likewise, we can observe how the fragment was appropriated and reconstituted throughout American history, speaking implicitly through movements such as Manifest Destiny, the Build Your Life and Pursue Your Rightful Claim to Land ideology that gave rise to westward expansionism in the United States. And it is this sheer multiplicity of meanings that make the Constitution politically and democratically tenable. Not just one right meaning, as reason, nowadays impoverished by a scientific obsession with absolutes, would have it. Instead, it is in its multiplicity that the Constitution can properly honor its democratic commitments. If democracy means that we each have the capacity to determine for ourselves what it means to live a good life, then the Constitution's literary mutability is not just a coincidence, but formally representative of a democracy's most basic tenets, to individually define what happiness and liberty means for each of us. And not just us, but future generations, making it a truly living document, one whose symbolic significations we can all confront, interpret, and change. This reminds me of Jacques Derrida's conception of language. For Derrida, words are infinitely repeatable and yet variable. They can be used again and again, even though their exact referent always changes. For instance, I can use the word pen to refer to the pen in front of me and again to refer to another different pen behind me. In each case, the word never changes, but its object, that which it expresses, does so constantly. In a similar way, the Constitution, understood literarily, expresses the meanings intrinsic to the worlds of our founders and those of today. It harmonizes them, keeps both worlds co-present while leaving open the possibility of new, future expressions, interpretations, and meanings. Through this coexisting multiplicity, we can always track back to the Constitution's ideological origins and see that though we have diverged from them, we will never definitively depart from them either. They are all part of the United States' narrative progression as a country, a narrative that, by reading deeply, we continue to author collectively. As Jeffrey Rosen shows us, the United States' vision is not one set in stone from distant monarchical sovereigns or divine law, but one we, the people, have the power to shape. It is a democracy to come, set in motion by the visionaries of the past. And now, back to the interview.
Yeah, to really pick things apart and not just try to compress it into what's newsworthy or clickable. I would love to sit in on one of those classes. Of course, I know that you are so imbibed in the beauty of the Constitution. It's a poetic document as well in its harmonies. But when it was written, they couldn't foresee things that we're facing today, current threats to democracy. So I know you're not critical of it, but what amendments or suggestions for revision would you like to include in it now, knowing what we do?
We just had a great project at the Constitution Center called the Constitution Drafting Project, where we convened three teams of scholars, liberal, conservative, and libertarian, to draft a constitution from scratch or to propose amendments. And we're so struck by the fact that within a week of Zoom deliberations, they were able to agree on five amendments to the Constitution, very ideologically diverse group of scholars. And the amendments included ending the natural born citizenship requirement for president, making amendment a little easier and impeachment in the House a little harder and conviction in the Senate a little easier. There was also a proposal for term limits for Supreme Court justices and a proposal to resurrect the legislative veto, which allows Congress to repudiate executive actions by majority vote. What's striking about all these proposals is they have to do with the structure of the Constitution, and they really are refinements rather than radical changes. None of the three teams wanted to start from scratch. They all maintained the separation of powers and the basic structure of the Constitution, but they thought it could be improved in these ways. And I think those are great suggestions.
And yes, I think they all sound very sensible because it's frustrating sometimes now dealing with older documents and the way society is now. As you were writing The Pursuit of Happiness, what were questions that you wanted to ask, you know, the different founding fathers or the different sources?
Well, of course, you want to know whether they think it's going to work. And at the end of their lives, all the major founding fathers were uncertain about whether it would work to different degrees. Jefferson, fearing civil war, yet still dreaming of the perfectibility of the human mind. Washington, afraid of factions. Hamilton, convinced the government wasn't strong enough and would be susceptible to being overturned by a demagogue. The fear that all of them had of demagogues, which would allow America to go the way of Greece and Rome. Only Madison, a little more cautiously optimistic because he expected less of the system. I want to ask them, are we going to be okay? Will it work? But of course, they didn't know any more than we did.
It's true. You know, I heard the book launch you did at the National Constitution Center, and I know that ended with a reading of an AI-generated sonnet. And, you know, at the time, I was finishing drafting my questions for this interview and was wondering, am I missing something? So I tried a similar experiment, and it turns out the AI-generated founding fathers and Stoics are all really interested in Jeffrey Rosen. Alexander Hamilton, Cicero, Mahatma Gandhi, they all had so many questions for you about the future of society and journalism. And I won't read them all here because they started to repeat themselves. But the gist was, what did you learn from us and how are you taking it forward? That basically seemed to be the tenet. But it is fascinating to have these conversations with these large language models, which have absorbed or scraped what we've fed to it. You know, what are your reservations about that? Or what do you think the possibilities of it are?
I'm concerned about the challenge to the Enlightenment faith in the centrality of reason. Machines can't reason. They can produce and assemble information without reasoning. And of course, on the most basic level, there's just the question of truth and the reality at the moment of hallucination by the machine, so that you really just can't trust what comes out without verifying it. It's such an antithesis to the kind of focus on primary sources and deep reading that's the foundation of my faith. No doubt there are great opportunities and possibilities, but at the moment, I'm determined to go back to the primary texts themselves. I just wouldn't feel right trusting an AI-generated bit of information unless I knew exactly what sources it was based on.
Yes, it's like a parrot and you don't know that they know what they're saying. You know, at the core of this book, and I think your life's work, it's how to live a good life, how to be a good person, and how to be a more engaged citizen. And as we think about the environmental crisis, we have to, I believe, sacrifice some of our comfort, going back to when talking about whether the founding fathers were able to sacrifice their comfort for the abolition of slavery. And this is, I think, one of the core questions for our generation is what are we willing to give up collectively in order to ensure the viability of future generations on this planet? So what do you feel their reflections would be on that particular crisis, and how can we move forward?
When I was rereading the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, I was struck by the idea of the environmental crisis being a kind of self-executing divine retribution for disturbing the harmonies of the universe. There's so many passages in the scripture which talk about the plagues and fires and punishments that come from failing to respect our place in the universe and having the hubris to imagine that we can transform and thwart the laws of nature. And these punishments are self-executing, and we are experiencing them. And the way to restore the harmony is the way that harmony has always been restored, which is by restraint and humility and living according to nature.
And so I think it's been the whole core of your book and projects, but as you think about the future education, the importance of both the arts and the humanities and your wider project and the importance of the Constitution and adhering to it, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
The radically empowering act of deep reading. It's a superpower that all of us have available if we just take the time to develop the habits of deep reading that are available to us every day. And it's a marvelous, thrilling, transformative time in human history that all the books in the world are online and access to them is not an issue. They're essentially free and waiting for us to learn from them. And all we need is the self-discipline to read them.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey Rosen, for all the work you do, for that reminder that we need to embrace the power of deep reading, and for your exploration of the core virtues, truth, and reason, and for reminding us of the importance of curiosity and lifelong learning. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you. The conversation has been a joy. Thank you for reading the book so closely, and it's been wonderful to talk with you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Virginia Moschetti with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Virginia Moschetti and Sophie Garnier. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anatolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.